That's a song sparrow recorded at the Carmen Valley in Sierra, California. Since the start of the 20th century, there have been institutions devoted to the collection and study of birdsong, namely Cornell University's Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. Their website features the following description of the song sparrow's song. A loud clanking song of 2 to 6 phrases that typically starts with abrupt, well-spaced notes and finishes with a trill. In between, the singer may add other trills with different tempo and quality. Definitions are only useful if they can use familiar language to describe the unfamiliar. I can't help but notice that the Cornell Lab often draws on vocabulary that is most familiar to musicians. For example, using a word like tempo instead of speed. In fact, there are other descriptors that are thrown around frequently. Glissandi, slur, virtuosic. For instance, the Northern Cardinal. A loud string of clear down-slurred or two-parted whistles, often speeding up and ending in a slow trill. The lark sparrow, a melodious jumble of clear notes and trills. Now listen to this musical account of a woodlark song, played at the piano, followed by a spoken description of the song. Slurred sequences of 2 to 3 note descents. The Eurasian curlew. A flutish melody with repetitive tremolos and glissando calls. Both of these descriptions were written by French composer Olivier Messiaen before he wrote music derived from both the woodlark's and the curlew's respective bird songs in the wild. I can't help but notice that the type of language used by Messiaen seems to match the type used by scientific institutions like the Cornell Lab. There's talk of phrases, of contours, of sound qualities. With this in mind, I wonder if a birder needs knowledge of musical terminology to identify song with species. If musical words are effective at describing, perhaps a person best positioned to birdsong identification is the musician. But my first guest is skeptical.
My name is Mark Barris. I, among other things, took over the ornithology courses and other avian physiology courses on campus, and kind of kept in that capacity for about 10 years.
And then in his role as an ornithology professor, Barris designed and taught courses devoted to birds of southern Wisconsin. In the past few years, he began developing a mobile app that allowed users to record live bird song while the app created a visual representation of the sound called a spectrogram. Various problems arose during the design and rollout of the app, which caused Barris to shift his focus to a new project, a book devoted to a holistic understanding of birdsong production and identification. Whereas many books on the market now may feature brightly colored pages and CD inserts that focus on rote memorization, Barris explores the physiological elements of avian vocalizations. It also features detailed spectrograms to demonstrate how certain species achieve such characteristic sounds. Since Barris has devoted so much time to the pedagogy of birdsong recognition, I spoke with him about the ways we describe birdsong, how both ornithological institutions and amateur birders so often resort to musical terms to describe many sonic characteristics. We also spoke about how Messiaen succeeds, or fails, at then translating these written language descriptions to music.
Bird songs do not really conform to our understanding of human music. And the whole idea of like notes and phrases, while you see that very common in the avian literature, I just don't buy it. No, it's just no. not at all.
But, you know, as a musician, I kind of see a good way of describing bird sound as musical language. So you have words like phrases or notes or trill and tempo, which I'm sure a lot of, you know, non-musicians could understand.
I have spoke with musicians before, and they invariably talk, I think, in terms of kind of a scale, you know, in terms of octaves often. But I don't think that does much to help in terms of avian vocalization recognition. While, you know, English is a wonderful language, words just don't exist to be able to capture the complexity of animal, specifically bird vocalization. Avian vocalizations can be so complicated. Being able to get the precise descriptions, I think, would be a lifelong challenge that would probably be unattainable. There's just too much variability in bird songs. And the example that you gave from Cornell on the song sparrow, that is a bird, very common bird in southern Wisconsin, that actually causes a tremendous amount of audio identification difficulties. That's because no two song sparrows sound the same. and so the while I enjoy Cornell's kind of definition of kind of this clankiness and then ending up with more of a trill, but then you saw in the middle, they kind of give this big aspect of melodic embellishment that they have. But to a attuned ear, you know, there's these six or seven notes that are kind of like a preamble to that trill. But that space in between is highly variable. And so really when you kind of think about song sparrows, is that, well, there is room for embellishment in terms of the singer, but this whole idea of variation has got to be in terms of your understanding. My own personal...
Barris spoke a bit longer about the problems associated with attempting to describe birdsong in general. Since Messiaen himself resorted to words to describe every species found throughout the catalog of birds, how much of a parallel is there between his written language found in the score versus the pitches and rhythms, the musical notation? For much of music history, instructions in words usually only took the form of a tempo marking at the start of a piece. Composers didn't necessarily have to think about notating elements of style, or what musicians call performance practice, because the people performing those pieces were either the composers themselves, or simply lived in the time of a general style, understood by most. As a result, there has always been a discrepancy between the notated page and the performance. If a computer software notated pitches and rhythms onto a staff while a great pianist played Chopin, certain understandings of style, little stretches of phrases or micro fluctuations in pulse, would likely render a page of notation that would look completely different from Chopin's actual score. In the 20th century, however, there was a sense that composers tried to overcome the obstacle of notation. Some, like John Cage, began giving less instructions in their scores, which perhaps provided more freedom to the performer, and also gave rise to the role of silence in a musical experience. Another school did just the opposite. They began putting more and more instructions in their scores, to the point where it almost seems there's more ink on the page than empty space. So how does Messiaen fit into these differing schools of thought? And where does that leave composers now?
My name is Steve Demski, and I've been composing music for public performance for about close to 50 years now. I taught at the University of Wisconsin for 34 years, from 1982 until last spring. At which point I quit to get back to work. And I've been since then getting back to work in a wonderful way. Mm-hmm. And so that's
after studying in Paris around the time Messiaen's seven volumes of the Catalog of Birds were published, Steve Demski served as Messiaen's translator for a few days during the composer's travels in America. On a subsequent trip to France in the 1980s, Demski attended a performance, potentially the premier production, of Messiaen's opera entitled St. Francis of Assisi. Fittingly, the St. Francis of Assisi opera details the life of the legendary Catholic saint who communicated with birds. Throughout the four-hour work, Messiaen used a large number of percussionists and woodwind players to achieve the kind of birdsong cacophony effect that we're hearing now. So as a composer, what do you notice about how he uses music to represent birds, both in St. Francis of Assisi and also in the Catalog of Birds?
With the birds in particular, he's made an attempt at transcribing these things. Mm-hmm. And of course, the attempt must fail. It can't possibly succeed. He takes birdsong and he tries to transcribe it in a specialist, imperialist way. he takes something from another species and tries to translate it into not only the music of his species, but the music of his continent. It's, you know, into a diatonic system, basically. And then he uses these things in a sense, in some ways, very much in the way the birds use them. The birds, they don't change them, and he doesn't change them either. He keeps them the same. He occasionally truncates part of them, or he adds a little, you know, he adds the last two. Bloop. And they're not notes in the birds. They're not, you know, there's no notion, a bird doesn't have a notion of notes. A bird's, you know, saying this stuff, but he moves it into this sort of intellectual conception of music made of notes. He drew, or seemed to draw intuitively, from the structure of birdsong, which is that repetition of a little figure.
Thank you.
Messiaen does it in a radically pure and consistent way. Mm. And that, to me, is really profound. Mm-hmm. That is really, it's much more profound than whatever the birdsong is. Mm-hmm. That way that this phenomenon, whether it's music or not, I don't know if birdsong is music or not, okay? But it's a phenomenon that happens audio. It's produced by living things, and it's used for a kind of communication. Mm-hmm. And it has a certain kind of standardization. He really genuinely went as far as he could to transcribe these things, to represent them as closely as possible, given the means that he had. Mm-hmm. They're audio artifacts of living beings that are not, that don't break down into notes. It makes it a project even more likely to fail to have an ornithologist who hear a failed transcription through a failed cognitive model, that is notes, through media that are not designed to reproduce these things accurately, and employed for entirely different purposes, which are musical purposes.
Where is there a measure of success?
That's ornithologist Mark Barris speaking again.
The idea of success might be interpreted in a strict ornithological sense of recreation of this avian utterance to be able to be recognized and to be structurally similar or nearly identical to that which you would see in the environment on a piano. Well, good luck with that. that's not going to happen. But if it's an interpretation, if art really is the attempt at translation, not wrong, you know, absolutely not. But maybe as a really strict ornithologist that listens to it and goes, no, I don't buy that at all. You know, that is not it. But was that really his intent? If it was his intent to really capture a perfect translation, I would say, yeah, no, you kind of missed the boat on that. But if the attempt was purely as an artistic interpretation of that translation of a very complicated natural avian sound to a instrument made by humans, who's to say he didn't succeed?
Well, I'd like to thank Micah Bear, who composed the theme song heard at the start of each episode. Thanks to Eva Ugurchik for collaborating on Messiaen's flute-piano duo piece, Le Miroir Noir, and to Dave Alcorn for recording it for us. If you'd like to see a video of us playing Le Miroir Noir, that's available on YouTube. Additionally, thanks to Brian Grimm for doing all the audio editing of my own playing. Essentially every Messiaen work that's heard throughout the podcast, with exception of St. Francis of Assisi. The Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology provided all of the footage of birdsong audio. Specifically, the recordists Randolph Little for the recording of the Song Sparrow, Julia Ferguson for the recording of the Northern Cardinal, Ed Pandolfino for the Lark Sparrow, Bob McGuire for the Brown Thrasher, and Linda McCauley for the Woodlark. I highly recommend exploring the Cornell Labs website, where you can play audio footage of any North American bird you can possibly think of. Most of all, I'd like to thank my guests that were featured on this episode, Todd Welburn, Steve Dembski, and Mark Barris. The music you're hearing now is from The Catalog of Birds, Book 3, Alouette Lulu, or Song of the Woodlark. I hope you'll enjoy listening to it through the end.